Hello, and welcome to Open Book, a podcast by National Records of Scotland dedicated to preserving Scotland's past, recording the present, and informing our future. Long before there was an Edinburgh Derby, before the offside rule and the Wembley Wizard or pies and bob roll, there was the football club, founded in Edinburgh by John Hope in 1824. It was the world's first dedicated football organisation, and although it was sent for an early bath in 1841, John Hope's meticulous records have been preserved among his personal papers here at National Records of Scotland. Today, we hear from midfield dynamo John Hutchison and star striker Andy Mitchell, who came to General Register House for a difficult away tie, to tell us all about the football club, about its extensive membership, and how they interlinked through sport and work, where they lived and where they were educated. At the end of the day, the lads gave it 110% and they left everything on the pitch. And they also introduced some startling links between the members of the football club and the following generation, the ones who would give us football in the form that we know and love it today. And now we head over pitch side ahead of kickoff.
Great, well, thank you, Tristan, for the introductions. We are going to work as a tag team, so we'll swap over from time to time. First of all, a quick show of hands from you. How many of you went to a football match last weekend? Not many. Okay. Because it's quite remarkable, in Edinburgh last weekend, about 100,000 people went to football of some kind, whether it was the rugby at Murrayfield, Hibs and Hearts were both at home, there's a couple of Scottish Cup ties. So that's about 20% of the population of Edinburgh, give or take a few, watched football. It kind of emphasises how important football is in this city. And today we're going to take you right back to how it all started and hear the story of the world's first football club, first known football club, I should say. So it was established in 1824 by John Hope, who was a young law student at the time. And it was called, appropriately enough, the Football Club, with a hyphen, and remained active for 17 years until 1841. It had hundreds of young men as its members, and it was therefore in existence about 40 years before the Football Association was formed, not to mention a good 20 years before the first attempts to codify the rules of football at Cambridge University, Rugby School, Eton College. So at that time, football was whatever you wanted it to mean. It was a game, kicking a ball. It was just sort of something you did as a pastime, but it wasn't played between clubs. So the very first football club being formed makes that crucial to the development of the sport. Although the club itself didn't make waves at the time. In fact, it kept such a low profile that there is not a single mention of the club in the newspapers of the day, and none of its members mentioned the club in their personal memoirs, those who published books of memoirs later on. It might even have been entirely lost to history, but thankfully John Hope was an obsessive hoarder. He filed away every scrap of paper during his life, an accumulation which by the time of his death amounted to over 200 boxes. And those papers were preserved, largely because of a long and messy legal challenge to his will, which meant they were needed to be referred to. And then they were carefully stored by a succession of conscientious Edinburgh lawyers, all working in the same office in Murray Place, where he had lived. But they now rest in this very building in the National Records of Scotland. So the Football Club papers represent an archive of immense historical significance, one which few other sporting organisations can emulate. And for example, in Scotland, there's no equivalent archive for Hibs and Hearts, for Celtic and Rangers, or pretty much any other club. But the papers are not just about football. They also show that sport is a vital part of our national heritage, and that sporting history isn't just about who scored which goal and when, but sport impacts upon all of society. And as we're going to show today, the Football Club takes us into all sorts of unexpected places. Pass to John.
As Andy said, we got to do things like a tag team, or as a two Ronnies act, whichever way you like to think of it. As Andy elegantly puts it, he does the number crunching and I do the waffly bits, i.e. the history. But first, a bit of background to our research. The football club records were packed up in the 1890s, more of which anon, and rediscovered by Dr. Neil Tranter of Stirling University in the 1990s. Here in this building, he had to wade through mountains of uncatalogued papers, some of which had not been touched for 100 years, and which were accessed through the reading room over there, into which you could only take a pad of paper and a pencil. He published a short paper on the club in 1993. I too waded through the same mountain with my pencil when Neil introduced me to the papers in the late 1990s. But by the following decade, when I published two papers on the club, many of the boxes had been catalogued. And as a great concession to modernity, laptops were allowed in the reading room, which was terrific. Today, a great deal of the material, including all the football club records, have been digitized. And you have no idea how much easier that makes it. The research started as a simple story of one man and his football team. It has, over the years, slowly evolved into a wider picture of society in the city of Edinburgh in the 19th century, the people who lived here and their influence on the world around them. To give you an example of the breadth of this, I've recently been compiling the index to our forthcoming book, editing, and the index includes the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bengal Native Infantry, Pollution and the Water of Leith, and the 6 Feet High Club. And I'd defy anybody to tell me what the links are between those subjects and John Hope's football club. It all goes to show how much this kind of detailed historical research has been transformed through access to the internet and newly digitized resources, particularly used in conjunction with traditional archives and libraries. And believe me, we historians are very grateful for that. So let's start with a look at the founder and power behind the club. John Hope was an important and influential character in 19th century Edinburgh in many fields. He was a social reformer, a philanthropist, town councillor, a Kirk Elder, a fighter for causes, and of course, a sportsman. He was born in 1807. He was a lawyer like his father, following his footsteps as a writer to the Signet. He lived almost his entire life in the new town and was extremely wealthy, never married, and devoted his fortune and his boundless energy to causes he believed in. And it should be said from the start that some of his beliefs will be judged by today's standards as extreme, as bigoted, and blinkered. His views on religion, for example, included ferocious and sustained attacks on popery, as he called it. And he was so obsessed with abstinence from alcohol that he insisted that his staff sign the pledge and fell out with numerous churches over their use of unfermented wine. For this, therefore, he has a fairly dodgy reputation. But he was also a passionate social reformer who spoke up for the poor and the downtrodden, for example, leading a campaign to introduce Saturday half holidays, organizing regular excursions to the countryside in East Lothian, West Lothian, for literally thousands of children from the Cowgate and the Canongate and various of the slum areas, as they were then, of the city, and providing education for them to escape. He is a firm believer in education to get out of poverty, to get out of the slums, and he put his money where his mouth is. He also believed firmly in the benefits of sport and exercise, and could be loosely described as an advocate of muscular Christianity, all of a particularly Scottish Presbyterian kind. Most of all, he stands out today because he loved football.
And that's where we come to the football club papers, which are a treasure trove of accounts, receipts, letters, and even a set of fledgling rules. But for me, the crown jewels are these membership lists. About 300 men are recorded as members over its life. And that's been the main focus of our recent research. Because it's important to shed light on who these trailblazers were, where they lived and worked, where they were educated, what their position was in society. And our clear conclusion isn't that this wasn't just some quirky, historically isolated football club for gentlemen in one particular city. This club had a significant influence on the early development of the game of football. And we've discovered close links between the members of the football club and the next generation of footballers, men who played in the early codified games of rugby and association football. And yet, despite this, you'll find that John Hope isn't really given much credit for his contribution to that early development of football. Most historians who research the origins of the association game usually focus on the founding of the FA in 1863, on the public schools, on Sheffield, and so on. And for example, Sheffield FC, founded in 1857 and currently celebrating the 160th birthday, claimed to be the world's first football club, and have actually incorporated that slogan into their crest there. But it simply isn't true. They might be the oldest surviving club, but the world's first, not at all. And that honour belongs to Edinburgh, and more specifically to John Hope. So in 1824, he was 17 years old and had just matriculated as a first-year student at Edinburgh University. So why form a football club? Well, Hope and his friends had all played football at the High School of Edinburgh, where the boys were actively encouraged to participate in sport and exercise. And there are numerous references of football being a popular game in the school yards. This engraving shows how the school looked in Hope's time, albeit the boys here are playing cricket rather than football. And this shows how the environment has hardly changed in 200 years since. You can walk around it now, it's just at the foot of Infirmary Street. So in the confined spaces of the high school yards, which is still the street name around the corner, they had a hard surface bounded by stone walls. And football evolved on a similar pattern to that enjoyed by boys at, for example, Charterhouse in Westminster in London, where full body tackling was likely to cause injury and at the very least damage to your clothing. So right from the start of football history, players from these urban schools tended to favour the non-carrying game and hence became early advocates of association-type football as we understand it today. However, football was generally considered a game for boys, not for responsible adults. And John Hope and his friends broke that convention when they decided that they would carry on playing after leaving school, on going up to the university or into the world of work. And they soon found that plenty of others were of the same mind.
As well as a love of football, there's another key factor in the story, and that is the already established sporting culture in the city of Edinburgh. Long before the football club was formed, middle and upper class men in the city subscribed to clubs, where they not only played sport, but they socialised together, eating, drinking, singing songs, telling jokes. They knew even then that it was good for the body and for the soul. So this includes a number of world firsts for Edinburgh. In this city, we had the first archery club, the first golf club, the first gymnastics club, and then, thanks to John Hope, the first football club. And we later had the first National Association of Clubs for curling. And where there are clubs, there are cups and there are trophies, and there are rules and competitions, especially when the members are all lawyers. So again, there are world firsts in golf, bowls, curling, and as we shall see, in football. You can see, therefore, that the template of sports club membership was well established by the 1820s, a decade which saw a national move towards athletic and more vigorous sports. And of course, because Edinburgh was a relatively small city and a tightly knit society, the members of different clubs all knew each other. An interest in one club led to an interest in another. The bowlers, for example, they curled in winter and so on. So in this context, the formation of the football club makes sense. By the 1840s, when this lovely print was published, football was clearly a part of everyday life. This is the view from Calton Hill, looking south with the roof of what was called the New High School just over the brow of the hill. It shows old and new Edinburgh, that familiar duality, the Jekyll and Hyde, if you like, with the classical Royal High Building and the Canongate Kirk representing the old, and the new represented by the footballers, the chimneys. And on the far side of the park, just underneath where the far side of the park, you can just see before the horizon is a chimney. And that is the chimney of the Innocent Railway. And it's perhaps the first pictorial reference to railways in the city of Edinburgh.
Okay, moving on to the club itself, some details of its activities to understand how it worked. These are absolutely crucial. These are rules which John Hope wrote in 1833. They might be on a scrap of paper, but these are the first known football rules, first attempt at football codification. They easily predate the Cambridge rules of 1846 and 1848, not to mention the founding of the FA in 1863, 30 years later. They are quite simple, but they indicate quite a lot. They tell us it was a kicking game between two sides with a defined playing surface and goals. And I'll go through them in some detail. The first two rules indicate a concern for safety and a desire to avoid injury. So number one, single-soled shoes with no iron. Number two, no tripping. Rules 3 and 4 introduce the method of scoring and a defined playing area. So ball to pass an imaginary line and a free kick if the ball is out of bounds. And rule 5 indicates a controlled amount of physical contact. Pushing is allowed, holding is not illegal. The meaning of rule 6 is rather less clear. And from the crossings out, it seems that Hope himself was unsure of the best form of words. It appears to me that the only time the ball could be handled was when it was out of play. So allow the ball to be lifted between fields. And underneath he notes what he saw as the attributes of this game. So AF, that's affirmative, fun, air and exercise. Some things don't change. Negative, no tripping. So clearly there was a method of scoring and opposing sides, although there are no records of matches actually being played. It was all within the club. And there's a strong indication that this was a precursor to what became association football, rather than the rugby variety with its practice of no handling, carrying or running with the ball. The playing equipment can be discovered through many receipts, accounts and letters. And this receipt, for example, from James Christian, son of George Street, shows that if you wanted a football in 1831, you had to have it made specially and pay handsomely. And the costs vary from 2 and 6 to 7 and 6. You also had to get the ball repaired when it burst, which was quite frequent. So they required a regular supply of fresh pig bladders. And this aspect is outlined in rather more detail in the club accounts, these ones for 1834, in which the costs of the paraphernalia for playing football are itemised. 3 bladders at 3d each, 6 laces at 1d each, tin pipe, wire, then 8 more bladders, some oil, cloth brush, a marine bag, marine's a type of canvas, and yet more bladders. Interestingly, a bottle of whiskey, which was used to clean out the bladders, which were rather unpleasant items. And then there's the payment of ground rental, called grass rent, as the club used a field which might otherwise have been used for grazing cattle. And there was also payment to an attendant whose primary job was to blow up and maintain the footballs. And right from the very start of the club, in fact, there were payments each week to a boy to come along every week to help out. There's very extensive correspondence, albeit largely limited to letters which Hope received rather than those he sent. This one in 1825 is from Henry Logan, a club member who'd gone to London, saying how much he missed the action of football. There was another letter from a member who went to Cambridge University in 1828 and effectively said that he didn't see much prospect of football catching on there. Somewhat ironic given the rule makers of the 1840s in Cambridge. But it's a further emphasis that Hope's football club was very much ahead of its time. And this letter from February 1841 is the final item in the club's history. It's a request from a John Campbell of 7 Great King Street, asking if the 3 or 4 friends could join. Now, Campbell already knew the club well, because he'd been a member 10 years previously. But it seems he was too late. There was no recorded response, and around 1841, the football club was wound up. Our general feeling is that Hope's organisational skills in running the club were a double-edged sword. He ran it single-handedly, and very well, but when he got too old and wanted to pass it on, there was no one suitable to take his place. He'd never got involved in the committee structure, or he'd never trained up anybody else to help him out.
So what of the club members? The records are not complete by any means. They cover 1824 to 1828, 1831 to 1834, and finally 1836. In all, over 300 members are listed over those 9 years. Some had a fleeting membership, and some came back year after year, and 3 of them were members throughout the club's entire history. These are the numbers season by season, and you can see it had a buoyant first few years before fading away. And we've been working to identify who the members were, where they came from, and what they did with their lives. The early membership lists gave only a name. Then in the 1830s, they also included an address, which of course makes research a wee bit easier. This kind of detailed research wasn't possible in my early days as a sports historian. So you can easily see how an old lag like me gets all excited about these new opportunities. It's not surprising that the members were largely within Edinburgh. Many of the young men had been at school here. John Hope, as we've known, was at the high school, as was his father, and most of his Edinburgh male society around him were also at the high school in the early 19th century. So there were strong links to that particular school, as you would expect. Although there's a bit of a research problem here, in that the high school registers appear to have been lost or destroyed during the move from Calton Hill to Barnton in 1969. But there's another school which features largely, and at least 56 members, that is over one third of those listed, were educated at the Edinburgh Academy, which opened in 1824. The Academy, as you know, subsequently played a crucial role in introducing rugby football to Edinburgh to Scotland in 1854, and that code remained dominant in Edinburgh until the 1870s. Yet this extensive club membership of former Academy boys is a strong indication that they'd played football for many years before that, and it was of the kicking variety rather than the carrying variety. A significant proportion of members were also schooled further afield before making their way to Edinburgh University. Within Scotland, they came from Dumfries and Dumfriesshire and the Scottish borders, right as far north as Orkney and Shetland, and all stations in between. And there was a scattering of English members too. At that time, Oxford and Cambridge universities only accepted Church of England conformists. So non-conformists and Roman Catholics were obliged to seek their higher education in Scotland or abroad. And Edinburgh University was a popular choice, particularly for medicine. When these young men came to Edinburgh to study, the fact that they had chosen to join the football club as soon as they arrived infers that they'd already played a form of football at home or at school. One example is George Witham, who was an English member of a club in the first 2 years while a medical student. He was a Roman Catholic who had been educated at Stonyhurst, a Jesuit school in Lancashire, which had a tradition of playing a form of football known as the Grand Match, with a pancake as a prize for the winners. Those of you who know something about medieval football will know the pancake is significant in that most medieval football games, particularly in this part of the world, were played on Shrove Tuesday, or as it was known locally in the borders, Fastern's Eve. And so that tradition was true also in Lancashire.
Right, moving on, where did they all live? Well, we've analysed the addresses, and from 1831 to 36, when the membership rolls include virtually all the addresses, there's pretty much every major street in Edinburgh's new town. as you can see the list there. And less than 10% of the addresses were from outside the Newtown area. And in fact, apart from three in the vicinity of the university, probably student lodges, none at all were in the historic old town of Edinburgh. What about careers? Well, most of the members were students when they joined. Almost all went on to be professional men, lawyers, doctors, army officers, commerce, and the church. And there's no evidence of lower middle class occupations such as shopkeepers or clerks. Now, given Hope's family and professional connections, it's little surprise over half the members whose careers have been identified became lawyers. And of those, most became writers to the Signet. The Edinburgh then, as now, was a city of lawyers. And lawyers then, as now, have the time, the affluence and the social status to join clubs and indulge in recreations. There are also strong connections to medicine, with quite a number of prominent surgeons and doctors in later life, such as Alexander Wood, who invented the hypodermic syringe. Three of the members became president of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. And there are fascinating stories in other fields. For example, James Kirkpatrick, who is pictured here, he was captain of Scotland in the first unofficial association football international of 1870, not to mention an FA Cup winner with Wanderers in 1878. He was a son of a football club member, Charles Sharp Kirkpatrick. And then we have Francis Moncrief, who was Scotland's captain in the first international rugby match against England in 1871. He was also son of a football club member, James Moncrief, himself a future Lord Advocate and founder of Grange Cricket Club. So the captains of the first two Scotland football teams, association and rugby, were both sons of football club members. And if you believe that sons learn from their fathers, then that is quite a remarkable legacy through the generations. And the principle is repeated in other families. And several sons of football club members have been identified as playing football, rugby or association after it was codified in the 1860s and 1870s at school and at university. There are numerous other stories about club members as they made their way in life. And just one quick example here. Several early members of the football club posed as subjects for the pioneering photographers David Octavius Hill and Robert Adamson in the 1840s. So these three pictures of James Rani Swinton on the left, Robert Dundas Kay in the middle, and James Moncrief on the right are probably the first ever photographs of football players. And apart from these individuals, how can the football club be linked to the future development of football? Now, we've come across a very frustrating gap after the club wound up in 1841, because throughout the 1840s, there is little evidence of organised adult football being played, not just in Edinburgh, but anywhere in the UK outside of the schools. But the 1850s, however, witnessed a new burst of football activity, and Edinburgh was again at the forefront. So the next event for which we have hard evidence dates from 1851, when the Edinburgh University Football Club challenged the 93rd Sutherland Highlanders, at that time garrisoned in Edinburgh Castle, to a match. And the losers agreed to present the winners with a silver medal. Here it is. And won by the soldiers, it's preserved in the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders Museum at Stirling Castle, and is the world's oldest football prize, apart from the pancakes he was talking about. And it depicts clearly a kicking association type of football. It's the only picture we have of soldiers playing football in a kilt. And there is a link to John Hope, because the Edinburgh silversmith who designed the medal was James Mackay. His son Robert was a schoolmate of John Hope and was also a member of the football club. So he was no doubt able to advise the engraver on the correct manner of play. And as the 1850s progressed, John Hope continued to be a catalyst for football. In 1854, he opened a playground in the city, next door to Raeburn Place, where the first rugby international was staged 2 decades later. So here at Stockbridge Park, he encouraged boys and girls to play football, writing that the game is strongly recommended as giving the most exercise and fun in a short time. He also laid down the rules of play, and his 1854 printed rules bear similarities not just to his 1833 rules, but also to the future codes for association football. And for example, he talks here of no hacking, which was the great divide between rugby and what became association football. The method of scoring is between the posts, as in association football. There is no handling, as in association game. The players wear distinctive uniforms with different colour caps, and good behaviour is a must. Unfortunately, after one season at Stockbridge Park, he wasn't able to renew the lease, and thereby he inadvertently opened the door to the handling rugby code. And that's because in the same year, in 1854, by an accident of fate, rugby football first took off in Edinburgh, at the very next door ground to his playground in Stockbridge at Raeburn Place. It's because the two brothers, Alexander and Francis Crombie, came back to Edinburgh, where they'd been brought up younger, after a couple of years at Durham School, which played football to rugby rules at that time. Francis, who was 16, went to Edinburgh Academy in 1854, just as the school opened its new sports ground in Raeburn Place. So the fact that he had his little booklet of rules, which described how to play football, was very useful. And it was adopted by the school as the method of play. And his elder brother, Alexander, who by that time had gone to university, still managed to make himself a founding member of the Academical Football Club, despite never attending the school. So the Crombie brothers, rather than John Hope, fulfilled the need for organisation and codification. And that's how the rugby code was taken up by first the Edinburgh Academy and very soon by the other principal schools in the city.
So here's a brief summary of the football firsts which Edinburgh can lay claim to. It's not that we're doing a kind of exercise in one-upmanship. Well, we are. But it's just that when I first started studying football in the 1960s and 70s, we were brought up with the idea that everything emanated from the public schools, largely in the south of England. And I think at the time we felt that really wasn't the case. There was more to it than that. And I think now we know that's to be true, to be the case. Although rugby football was widely adopted in Edinburgh from the 1850s, John Hope continued to promote the non-handling game. When association football finally came to Edinburgh in the 1870s, thanks to the missionary efforts of Queen's Park, he encouraged the soldiers in his volunteer regiment, the 3rd Edinburgh Rifle Volunteers, to form one of the city's first clubs. And he actually kicked off their first match. And when they won their first trophy in 1876, which was the Edinburgh Shield, it was presented not to the club captain, but to him. For those of you with a knowledge of Edinburgh football, one figure who stands out is Frank Watt, who's the wee guy in the middle of the picture there. He was a founder of the Edinburgh Football Association in 1875, which, in deference to John Hope, was a teetotal organisation then. It's changed since then. And later went on to be secretary of Dundee and Newcastle United. The 3rd ERV played for a while, then developed into St Bernard's Football Club, who won the Scottish Cup in 1895 and was a member of the Scottish League. So John Hope was part of a thread which ran right through the 19th century, from the formation of the football club in 1824 to victory in the national club competition at the end of the century. But John Hope, alas, wasn't around to see that triumph. He died in 1893, and he left most of his fortune to the Hope Trust, a religious charity. He was one of the city's richest men, with a fortune which was worth about somewhere in the region of £50 million in today's money. Although he never married, he had an extended family who were naturally distraught at getting nothing from the old man. So they mounted a legal challenge, which claimed he suffered from insane delusions when he wrote the will. It took 6 years to resolve. The family lost, but they got a substantial payoff. And we suspect, reading between the lines, this was to prevent any more dirty laundry being aired in public. And the outcome was that the Hope Trust, which still exists, continued its work promoting temperance and the Protestant religion. Until quite recently, they remained based at 31 Murray Place, which was Hope's old house and office. And that stability helped them to preserve his archive, which was eventually passed here to the records. Now, if you remember earlier in this talk, I mentioned a few obscure links to the football club and to John Hope's life and philanthropy. I mentioned the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was Archibald Campbell Tate, who was the first Scottish Archbishop of Canterbury. His elder brother Crawford was at school with Hope and a founding member of the football club in 1824. The Bengal Native Infantry also links to the Tates, as Crawford Tate was an ensign in that regiment. Three other members of the football club also served with it in India. Pollution in the water of Leith was a bugbear for John Hope in the 1850s and 60s when he was a town councillor. He campaigned against the Caledonian Distillery, discharging effluent which ran through the city, and of course was doubly perturbed because it was involved in the production of alcohol. And finally, the 6 feet high club, founded in 1825 with its rather obvious height restriction, was the thinking man's fitness club, with members including Sir Walter Scott, who wasn't tall enough, so he was an honorary member, James Hogg, who I'm not sure was tall enough either, Professor John Wilson, known as Christopher North, and they have connections with this area around here. He was one of the many sporting clubs which sprang up in the 1820s, emphasizing the athletic culture of the city, which allowed the football club to survive. Although we've mainly talked about football today, John Hope's story is not just about football, important as that is, as Mr. Shankly said. He also had a huge influence on the number of other fields in the development of Edinburgh society in the 19th century, of religious intolerance, education, housing, philanthropy. And his life helps you just to get a feel about what it was like to live in the Edinburgh society at the time. Andy and I recently published a paper about him on soccer and society, which if you need a cure for insomnia, we're happy to circulate on request. But he really deserves a book. And we're now working on a full-scale biography of John Hope and the story of his football club. And we're nearly finished. We hope that you've heard enough today to hear about thinking about buying it when it comes out next year. Thank you for listening.
This podcast was produced for National Records of Scotland by Ross Truslove. It's copyright of National Records of Scotland, and all rights are reserved.